Arguments over words are settled much more quickly in our time. With computers and smartphones all around us, we can look up words to correct friends or win battles over Scrabble games. And while we're using the internet, we're often using the reliable old sources of word knowledge, like the Oxford English Dictionary. The gigantic book with the little type and the magnifying glass has a storied history, and today's guest lived a chunk of it. John Simpson is the author of a memoir called The Word Detective. He is the former chief editor of the OED. He was involved in taking the venerable dictionary onto the internet for the first time. John currently lives in Gloucestershire in the UK, writing about many matters, including words. John Simpson, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jeff. Nice to be there.
How does one train to be a lexicographer?
Well, that's a tricky question, because I didn't really think I wanted to be a lexicographer. It didn't really occur to me when I was at school or something in the 60s. I think what we want in a historical lexicographer is someone who's not interested in he doesn't get besotted by words, but treats them analytically. So what the job involves is reading a lot of sentences about particular words, the words you're working on, and trying to extract the meaning and the history from those examples to write a biography of a word is what we're trying to do.
Almost like doctors of words. So no poets need apply? Is that part of what goes on?
Well, actually, we're quite keen on poets. We're more keen on poets than we are on appointing linguists, actually, because linguists have theories, and we're very, very data-based. We're dealing with the real examples of language rather than theories. So, yeah, you can send poets along if you like.
John, you're right that the public perception of lexicographers is of a dull, plodding crew. What's the truth?
Well, we've done our best, haven't we? I got the impression whenever a journalist came to see me in the office, so we employ in the end about, when I left, we had about 75 people working on the OED. But I sort of got the impression they were expecting an awful lot of beards and a lot of white coats, actually they were quite surprised when they came in and found actually quite a lot of young people, quite a lot of women and men, half and half, very few beards. Actually, these days, beards are more in fashion, so maybe they're creeping back again now. But what I wanted to do in the book was to give a true impression that actually writing and discovering the history of words is actually great fun rather than just rather dreary, as some people think.
I like the metaphor you use of the English language as a mosaic. I mean, is the job essentially about polishing tiles in that mosaic?
Well, it's finding the tiles. It's finding the tiles, placing them in the mosaic, and then eventually standing back and seeing the whole picture of the language. So, yeah, it's both ends of the job.
Does the OED maintain a somewhat different role in the language from other dictionaries?
It's a historical dictionary, so it's trying to look at how language is used and describing that, rather than, we call that descriptive lexicography, rather than prescribing how people should use language. But these days, most dictionaries don't try and tell you how to use it. They tell you how language is used and give you options to choose whether you want to break the rules or not.
You had already done some college work on words from other languages, I understand, before you got to the OED, and I guess that prompts the question of whether English is one of the largest borrowing languages in the world.
Whether English borrows extensively from other languages, we started off 1,500 years ago as a Germanic language. Our basis was principally the words from the German languages of North Europe, where English came from, but we've actually been a very receptive language after that. There are some languages in Europe particularly, France and Spain traditionally are the ones that don't like, want to remain a sort of pure language and don't like necessarily introducing words from abroad. But Britain's always been very open to foreign influences, so we have an awful lot of... Well, we didn't have much choice at the time of the Norman Conquest,
right.
We ended up introducing a lot of French words into the Germanic bedrock of English. But as a trading country, we've been accepting words as well as goods from other countries for a very long time. We're a pretty open language.
When you talk about the pace of the writing, the construction of the Oxford English Dictionary, which we'll get into in detail in a couple of minutes here, it sounds like it's hard though to keep up with the language because usage changes so fast.
Yeah, and it's not just in Britain and America, but it's anywhere else that English is spoken in the world. And nowadays, with more people, more communication, that causes the to change to happen more quickly. So, yeah, I don't think we'll be out of work for a while. the language just keeps on changing. And also, it's not just the new words nowadays, but we also make new discoveries about old words as well. So maybe some time ago, somebody sent in to us a 25-year antedating of the word numismatics, which took it back out of the 18th century into the 17th. And that was exciting for us. You know, that's the sort of thing that gets us quite excited, when a word gets back into and is discovered to come from a new century.
Oh, well, sure, yeah. That really would tend to light the fire under a word detective.
I find that fun anyway.
Does the OED move too fast, though, now that it's online? I ask this because I saw the clipping this morning about the fact that YouTubers has been added, and so has Glamma, and I wonder...
Yeah, I saw that, yeah. And that's because I think that today is one of the 4 days in the year when they're adding new words, publishing new words to the dictionary. And actually, today is the first day that that Brexit's apparently officially been published, although the term's been around for some time. I think the ones that you probably see in news releases are the sort of tip of the iceberg of the change. There's an awful lot going on behind the scenes, dusting off old words and correcting and updating those as well. So, yeah, it doesn't worry me. We're quite a generous language, and the OED is quite a generous dictionary. It doesn't mind putting in a few things from the borderline. But in general, words have to have demonstrated continuous use for, you know, 5-10 years or so before they get into the dictionary. So often these terms, even though you might think they're really new now, have probably got a bit of a history. I haven't checked YouTube, but it's probably been around for
back
a
in
while.
One minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is John Simpson, the former chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. Yes, the big Oxford English Dictionary. Big book, small type, magnifying glass. He's written a book about his time there and his interest in words. It's called The Word Detective, Searching for the Meaning of It All at the Oxford English Dictionary. You can join us on the Exchange. We'd love to talk about words here. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. As venerable as it is, it turns out the OED is not as old as we might think. It was not, for example, first written by William the Conqueror. When did it start, John?
Yeah, no, William the Conqueror didn't seem to be very interested in the English language. The germ of the idea of the OED started in 1859 was it 1857? 1857, at a series of discussions of a London Philological Society. And that's where the idea came up, but it was about another 30 years before they actually published anything, because it took such a long time to collect information together for the letter A. And so, yeah, it's late Victorian dictionary, but it was finished 44 years later, after the letter A, in 1928. So it had a long gestation period.
As you point out, though, that is not the longest it took to get a dictionary going, because there's a German dictionary, I think, that actually beat it.
The German dictionary started before the OED. That's the Grimm dictionary, the Grimm's dictionary. Started in the 1840s and finished in 1960, so 120 years. Yeah, the OED was really working on speed skates, really, even though it took 44 years.
Well, you know, the assembly and construction of a dictionary is so fascinating to me, because I've always wondered how you start a dictionary without cribbing from existing dictionaries.
Yeah, the OED's key selling point initially was that it was based not on other dictionaries, but on a new collection of empirical data. So it had readers all around the world, American readers, British readers, readers elsewhere, who were going through books, novels, documents, or whatever, writing out on index cards example sentences that they came across for words that they thought were used in a novel way, or new words, or were described in a way that was useful to the dictionary. And all this material was collected together at the end of the 19th century in Oxford, and the editors then work through these cards, compiling their entries from the data they found there and using that as hints to research words further.
So there must have been mountains of cards in walls full of card files.
Yeah, pigeonholes they call them, and the editor used to pay his children pocket money to file them in alphabetical order when they came in from the readers. So poor old children, but it was a useful source of income, I should think.
No doubt. Better than babysitting. When you first joined the OED, and it was in 1976, what was your sense of its relevance in that time?
Oxford was a sort of old world place at the time. I mean, in many ways, that's quite an attractive feel, but it wasn't going forward. I didn't feel the OED was going forward. We were working on a supplement to the original 19th century dictionary. There was a sense that as I came to know the place after a few years, that the university press wasn't really very keen on producing another paper supplement to a paper supplement, and that somehow the dictionary had to watch out for its future if it wasn't careful. And at the same time, there were developments technologically. People were putting text onto computer in a very early sort of way, not in a big way. People were storing them on punch cards and then on magnetic tape and then on CD-ROMs. And we sort of got the germ of the idea, various of us at the University Press in Oxford, that maybe the dictionary could go onto computer. This was years before the internet. It might actually give it a future because you could then update it if it was on a computer medium rather than on paper.
Okay, well, we'll talk later about you taking it online while you were the chief editor there, but I want to come back to the beginning of your career at the OED, and
yep.
How did Icelandic and J.R.R. Tolkien help you get the job at the OED?
I'd been doing an English literature course at university in the 70s. I'd been studying Old English, but I sort of thought Old English is fine and interesting, and there's a lot of religious stuff and a lot of battles, but it was medieval Icelandic that had the sort of the saga history, the stories of the family feuds, and I wanted to be able to read that. So I knocked on the Icelandic tutor's door one day and said, you know, can I, as well as doing Old English, can I also join your course for medieval Icelandic? So I did that, and that was actually helpful because it turns out that a knowledge of any medieval language is very relevant to defining and working out the etymologies of modern words today. So actually, it was a very good grounding. I didn't think it was going to be a good grounding for anything, and I'm not even sure my tutor thought it was a good grounding for anything other than teaching other people medieval Icelandic. But it actually was just what was needed for the historical perspective you need on the OED. And Tolkien himself had been an editor on the OED. He worked on the word walrus and various words like that towards the end of the dictionary's time in the 1920s. So other people have found it a good start as well.
John Simpson's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Word Detective, Searching for the Meaning of It All at the Oxford English Dictionary, where he worked for 37 years. And I laughed, though, and sweated with you a little bit, too, at your unease in the presence of the editor of the concise Oxford Dictionary.
That's right. Yeah. I went for an interview on the dictionary, and the editor of the OED, the full OED himself, was a very charming sort of vain gentleman, full of medieval Icelandic as well as me. We were joined in the interview by his colleague, John Sykes, who was the editor of the Concise Oxford Dictionary. The job I was actually applying for at the time was on the Concise Oxford Dictionary, which I don't think really would have suited me. But he didn't really say very much. He was a crossword freak. He won the London Times crossword competition countless times. In fact, he didn't compete every other year to give other people a chance. That was the sort of level he used to compete at. But he was an absolutely fascinating man, but he didn't communicate it all the time to me anyway.
Well, in fact, you did not get the first job that you were up for.
No, that's right. I was applying for this job on the Concise, and I didn't get that. And I thought, oh, well, back to kicking stones up the road or whatever I was doing. And then I got another letter about 2 months later saying, actually, a job vacancies had arisen on the full Oxford English Dictionary, and would I be interested in that? And, yeah, of course I was. So then I sort of rushed back, and that's when I started working on the dictionary.
There are many asides in the book, I should point out, for specific words that you give a little ramble on definition and etymology as well.
I wanted to, there were about 60 of those. I just wanted to just to stop and talk about words that I found myself writing in the memoir that I thought were interesting. I didn't really want to take a set of the standard words that you talk about in histories of English, but just words that came up in the discussion.
Well, and a great one at this point in the book, as you talk about setting up your office and your desk, is paraphernalia. Where did that
that's
one come
right.
from?
Yeah. Well, that's a strange word. It comes from Renaissance law, actually. It's first recorded in Britain, I think, in the early 17th century. It comes from Greek, and it means, literally, in law, all of the possessions that a wife kept as her own personal property when she got married, because most of her property went directly to her husband, as you would appreciate under the legal system at the time. But there were some things that maybe jewelry or clothing that were personal property that the wife was actually allowed to keep. So paraphernalia was originally everything that didn't belong to your husband automatically on marriage if you were a wife. And now and after that, it developed into meaning the sort of trappings or accoutrements of anything. But yeah, it's got all of these words have got interesting stories if you bother to look at them.
What do words often tend to get broadened in meaning because of the fact that somebody likes the word? Well, that sort of references what I'm thinking about here, and so they'll use it for something it was not originally used for. And does it broaden in that way, or does it just shift?
Yeah, well, I mean, what happens in word creation is that we don't usually come up with completely new words because nobody would understand them. So we shift a bit what we already have. And so paraphernalia was broadened out from meaning something specific to something more general. It's more normal for words to broaden out in meaning than for them to narrow in meaning, but that's possible as well. That happens as well. Or new words are formed by compounds of old words or by suffixation. Post-truth, for example, which was the Oxford word of the year, was another example of these words with a suffix post added to an existing noun. So not much is created completely new. You merge together things that already exist.
I wonder, and this is very much an aside, if you were aware of MTV trying, I guess, in the early to mid-90s, trying to create words and just sticking them out there and just seeing if people would use them.
Now, you see, we didn't have the technology that you had. I'm not sure I had MTV at that time. We didn't just have the two channels then, but you were a bit ahead of us. So what were MTV, what did they create at the time?
Well, they tried to put a few new words out there, and they were honest about it. They were just, you know, hey, these, you know, and I forget, it was adjective type things, but it didn't stick. I mean, so a deliberate effort to make new words didn't happen then.
It's not the best way to do it, really. Yeah, I mean, you don't really know, you can't, unless you're a politician who invents a new concept and throws it out at people, then you're going to find it hard to actually develop a new word, get it widely used, and get it registered in dictionaries. But it happens to some people, not when you're not expecting it, probably.
That's probably the biggest part of it. John Simpson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His memoir is called The Word Detective, Searching for the Meaning of It All at the Oxford English Dictionary. It's about his 37 years at the OED, leaving as chief editor, the changes in technology, the changes in his own life, the changes in words over time. He's obviously learned a little bit about words over that time. Join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I mentioned our listeners like to talk about words. Here's Paul in Grants Pass. Paul, go ahead. Paul in Grants Pass. Okay, I'm getting the echo, but I'm not getting the sound of him. So he's not there. Let's talk about what your tasks were in the early days at the OED, John.
Yep. The very first word I was given to work on was the word queen. And I thought that was what I came to the dictionary to work on words. But actually, before that, the first task they gave me was reading a book on French film theory, because they wanted to include a lot of French film theory semiotic terms in the card files, and they thought that was good. So actually, I had to spend rather a boring 3 weeks reading this book that nobody else in the department wanted to read, and because I was a new boy, I was told to read it four words and write it index cards for about 200 of the film theory terms there. So I was quite pleased when that was done. I mean, it taught me a bit about the card files and where books were in the department. It was a sort of learning process. But the first real words I was asked to work on were the word, new senses of the word queen. So maybe it was the queen bee, for example, or the homosexual use of queen was one of the words I was working on. So, yeah, and by working on them, I mean that my my supervisor gave me the whole collection of index cards that had been collected at this point. This was in 1976, so we weren't on computer at the time. All the index cards that had been collected over 100 years for the word queen had been sorted into different subsenses, and I had to work through these, improve the historical documentation, write a definition, see how they fitted into the big OED's entry for queen that already existed. It was good fun, but it was it was quite tough. There was an awful lot to learn. I sort of feel I spent 5 years just learning the ropes on the dictionary, really. All the grammatical policy, language policy facts we had to know before you could actually feel you could freely write an entry in your own right. It was a bit like being, you know, an article clerk in the law or something. You just had to learn all of the precedent before you could actually start working and feeling you could freely define yourself.
Along apprenticeship, and that's another one of the words that you help us
understand. That's right, yeah, that's another word, yeah.
So I'm curious that you mentioned queen and the homosexual sense of it, and this gets into an area of working in a dictionary that has some surprising level of controversy, because you write about the fact that you and Hillary got married just after you got started at the OED. So you define the word marriage, but you also remind us, oh yeah, marriage can be defined differently at different times in history, as we've certainly learned in recent years. So when you start thinking about terms like marriage and abortion and Palestine, I imagine there's a fair amount of people who don't like the definitions the OED comes up with.
Yeah, we did receive letters from people who objected to particular definitions. Over time, it was different. I mean, we used to get English people objecting to the introduction of what they regarded were Americanisms in the dictionary, or we'd get religious, sometimes cults, sometimes just people with a sort of different religious perspective who disagreed with the perspective of the dictionary definition. But essentially, you're working from it's not the word's fault; it's the fault of the people who use the words. If you object to something, so all we were trying to do was look at the evidence for how a word was used and to relay that neutrally through the definition. So we always felt that if we were objective, then we couldn't be accused of getting it wrong. It would just be the perspective of how it's used in the real world.
Let's take a call, and I have to admit I pushed the wrong button last time, so this time I have the right button for Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to The Exchange with John Simpson, the author of The Word Detective.
Oh, people are always pushing my buttons. That's not a problem. So I have to thank you, sir, for all of your hard work. I used to be involved with and play Scrabble with a PhD in English, and the OED saved my bacon many, many times. It was always a knife fight, so I bow to you, sir, and thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm not sure I'm all that good at Scrabble myself, actually. I don't have the CD-ROM in my head, but I opt out sometimes of playing Scrabble.
That's what
anyway,
I was going to ask. He just wanted to thank you. There was no question.
Oh, okay,
that came
right, okay, that was good. Yeah, well, that was very nice. Yeah. Well, as I say, Scrabble. People are always terrified of the idea of playing Scrabble against me, but I don't know. I was asked once to if I compete in a sort of an open Scrabble competition with one of the British champions, and I rather cowardly declined, but I think I'd have been wiped off the face of the board, really, by somebody who really knows all of those three letter words that you can use.
That's refreshing to know. Sorry. I really would have thought that you were barred by a law, or at least by friends and family, from playing Scrabble. But
yeah, you think so? Yeah. I do it myself. I veto myself from playing.
Let us take a call from Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Simpson.
Yeah, thank you. Brad of Ashland, but I'm starting to use my first name, Byron, now in society, so that'll transition. Anyway, I called because the dictionary is huge. I mean, it's a huge thing, and it's full of words, and people made up those words at some point. And yet we struggle with he and she and they as a way of trying to refer to people without including their gender. So what's the word? Is there any new words coming along down the pike that we can use besides these ones?
It's difficult, isn't it? Because people have tried to introduce gender-neutral words from at least the middle of the 19th century, and they've not really been successful. It's this old issue of completely new words not fitting into the language easily. So we don't in the OED definitions, but you'll find some dictionaries will start a definition with he or she, and then later on we'll say they as a pickup point in the definition. But that's just using existing words rather than introducing a completely new a gender-neutral term. I think it's difficult. I mean, we use Ms. or MS, which is a sort of not gender-neutral, but it bridges a gap.
It's relationship neutral anyway.
In relationships, yeah, and that was first used by in the States. I think in quite early on, it was actually tested out in the 20s and 30s. I think. I haven't got an answer to this. No, we observe. We don't create. But yeah, it'd be interesting to observe whether any developments happen on that front over the next few years.
Okay, Brad or Byron, whichever name you go by. Thanks for the query. John Simpson is our guest on The Exchange. His book is The Word Detective. We will take a short break and come back and take more phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're having some fun with words today in this hour of the Jefferson Exchange with John Simpson, who is the former chief editor of the Oxford English Dictionary. He spent 37 years at the OED and was involved heavily in getting the OED online where it is today, in addition to the form in which most of us got to know it, which was a large book with small type and a magnifying glass. John Simpson's book is called The Word Detective, Searching for the Meaning of It All at the Oxford English Dictionary. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. John, is the OED the original crowdsourced text? It seems like you got a lot of input on making it.
Yeah, when the word crowdsourcing came up about, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, we started thinking, well, actually, that's how the OED got its information even from the 1850s onwards, because it was appealing, it was making appeals to the British and American public to send in information about the language, and it sort of worked amazingly. And so we'd go for we were the first crowdsourcer badge, if we can have it.
That's fascinating. Let's let's take a call from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Got a quick idea for John Simpson?
I got a lot of ideas. Three languages. So that's German and English and German dialect and the intricacies and the detective work about them. And there are so many things, like the languages, most languages we are dealing with are actually androcentric in their origin. So the way that things are referred to by gender is... The default for friend is in English is male, and that's why you say girlfriend. You also say boyfriend, but you usually don't say boyfriend unless it's a romantic interest, blah, blah. I mean, lots of things. And then comes the geographic and the time factor into the English language. Like, if you have one example that I've came up with, and it's, if you talk about somebody as a four-on-the-floor type of person, what does that mean, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you read a passage that says, like, referring to it's hot out there in the savannah, even if you're not a mad dog or Englishman. Mm-hmm. So if you don't know Noel Coward, you don't know what that means. If you don't know Aussie language, historical Aussie language, you don't know what it means. So the detective thing is totally on the money, because you have to, if you translate, which is what I do both ways, you have to learn to understand what did they mean and what was the context and what's the time, or the famous the buck stops here, having somebody say the buck stops here in 1920 is, of course, nonsense.
All right.
Yeah, that's why we call ourselves historians of language or writing biographies of words, because the context is everything. You've got to look at, you have to try and take a word back to when it first entered the language and look at the context then to see why it was a necessary, relevant word and what the links were with other languages at the time. So, yeah, no, I quite agree. Context is absolutely vital in studying words.
Let's take another call from Jacob in Gold Hill. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with John Simpson.
Hello, this is Jacob from Gold Hill.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know what you do, or is it possible to maintain the same definition for a phrase or a word? My example is one of the things that drives me nuts, and I hear it from quite well-educated people, at least I presume they are, the term begging the question, or someone this begs the question, and they use it to mean that it requires your response or someone says something and say, well, this begs the question, as though it demands the question. And that's not what begging the question means.
Yep, that's quite right. There are two meanings in operation for that at the moment, and there's an older meaning, which many people hold is the single soul and right meaning, and then there's the begging the question requiring an answer, which is the other one you mentioned. I tend to use the second meaning myself, so I'm probably in the wrong. But I think our view really is that as I've said before, we're describing how language is used, and in the same expression can be used in different ways. Breaking the mold is another one that people object to a modern secondary use, rather like begging the question. But I think really you have to. We tend to believe that you have to accept that there's sometimes more than one answer to these expressions, and the definitions will the definition should retain the older meaning, but also add the newer meaning if it's widely used.
Well, and that raises the question then about whether, and of course it's hard to know because we have dictionaries, what the world would be like without them, but whether you think dictionaries provide something of a break, slowing the changes in language because there is a fixed portrait.
I think my view and my hope is that we come along afterwards and observe what's going on rather than change them. We don't have a role in Britain and America for guiding the language. I mean, there are hidden guiders to the language, and the education system and newspaper style guides and things, they influence how people think things should be spelled. I feel that dictionaries come along afterwards and report on how it is used rather than tell you how to use it. That's my view anyway.
I wonder, John, if it's a bit like rain. There are some days when the words come down hard and fast, and some days when they just sort of sprinkle in. It seems like
there are times that are very productive of words, and it's when something big is happening in the world. It's going back to this question of context that was mentioned just now. If there's a major war, a new type of war going on, or a new type of sort of threatening disease affects humanity, or some major event like that, that will tend to develop new words. So at that period, you'll find in a particular subject area that the words are proliferating, and at other times when it's a bit quieter. So yeah, there are variations. Yeah, you have to keep your watch on for the Olympics, for example. You know, you sort of know that there are going to be some new words that may come up then, because a lot of people are talking about a whole set of different sports, Paralympics and other sports. So yeah, you're sort of on the lookout for things happening there. And other times it's quieter. So yeah.
You know, when I think about the Olympics, though, and I was trying to think of terms that popped to mind from recent Olympics, and the term Blade Runner, but that came from a movie.
From a movie, yeah, movies are a good, Sophie's Choice, other things, yeah. Every time there's an Olympics, people in Britain object to the verb to medal, to be medalled.
He medalled in the games. Yeah,
that's right, he medalled in the 1500 metres or something. And English people, every time they're surprised, it's like Groundhog Day, they don't realise it's been around for a long time, since the 40s or something, but each time an Olympic comes along, it's Groundhog Olympics, and we all object to it again, at least people do.
Patricia in Grants Pass dropped off a question, wants to know what percentage of English language is German words, and she also wants
The easy answer is 50%. What actually happens is that the most commonly used of the 100 most commonly used words in English, and they're usually the little words or the numbers or the prepositions or whatever, about 98 of those are Germanic or Scandinavian words and one or two nation, for example, an early French word. So the vast majority of the core words of the language are Germanic-based and predate the Norman conquest. And many of the slightly longer words, like recognize or apprehend or whatever, the words we use to define abstract concepts probably more subtle concepts than some of those old Germanic words, which have been blunted over the years, are Romance French words or from elsewhere. So yeah, on a strict number count, it's sort of maybe 50%. But actually, on a usage basis, it's much more heavily Germanic.
Interesting. Okay, so German as a or Germanic anyway as a root for us. You mentioned the word recognize, and it prompts me to ask the question about people who use eyes and eyesation, and whether there are any particular usages of the language that set your teeth on edge.
Well, the Oxford style is to use IZE. The American style is to use IZE. The current British style, predominantly in the education system and elsewhere, is to use ISE. So I used ISE for all those words before I joined the dictionary. I then switched like a robot into IZE when I was using a house style on the dictionary. Mm-hmm. And then now I've left, I've gone back to ISE. So that's not doesn't help when I write to Americans, but they sort of understand.
Yeah. But spelling
it's not
aside,
that difficult.
Right. But spelling aside, I mean, the use of when people say like, oh, you know, we have to go through a finalization process on that, or when
right.
people even
yeah.
even pervert analysis into analyzation.
Yeah, finalize is a word that was originally an American usage at the turn of the 19th and early 20th century. And at the time, it was really objected to in the UK as the beginning the barbarians at the gates. The language was going to, you know, if we were going to use words like finalize. Anyway, we got used to that, so nobody thinks of it as an Americanism now. And so now, having said that, I've now forgotten your question. But anyway, I'm sure it was, I'm sure it'll be... Yeah, so where was it leading?
Just the whether there are any particular usages that that you dislike and you don't you prefer not to.
I dislike. Yeah, I mean when I'm theoretically entirely neutral and objective. I don't know. Yeah, some words rile me a bit. I forgot what they are at the moment. Hassle. I never much like the word hassle. I never really got used to that. There are lots of alternatives you can use instead. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Just personal taste. Don't tell anybody.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Except for the few thousand people listening.
Yep.
Let's go to Mark in Reading. Thanks for calling the Jefferson Exchange with John Simpson.
Yes. Are there any archaic words that get dropped over time?
Yeah, there are many. I mean, some of them still remain in as fossilized in expressions like dribs and drabs, for example, or beck and call. We know what call is. We don't really know what beck means, but we use it still in beck and call. And it used to exist. Take the word inkling, for example. You have an inkling of something. You'd imagine if it ends in ing, there used to be a verb to inkle, meaning to hint or something like that, to give a hint of something to happen. And indeed, 500 years ago, to inkle did exist, but we've lost it, and all that remains is the present passable form inkling. Words are dropping out of the language all the time.
Back to your own personal story in history with the OED, 37 years there. You write of bringing the curtain down on old-style Oxford lexicography. How different is it now from when you started?
Well, I mean, like many offices, there are a lot of computers around. There is an awful lot of computer power behind that, telling us things about language. In the early days, we had to look at index cards and work out for ourselves what various patterns were. To some extent, that's done for you on machines these days. They can give you statistical counts of what's in your text corpus, for example. But a lot of the work is still the defining is still the old Victorian values of an elegant definition, of a concise definition, choosing the right words. So there are computational helps. But the essential job, I think, is still the same as it always was and probably always will be.
Jeffrey and Ashland sent an email in asking, why do we willfully let language be dumbed down by adopting incorrect usage like literally?
There are a lot of... excuse me. A lot of changes in the language go through a period of sort of probation before they're accepted. And it sometimes takes about 50 years for a word, for a new usage to be entirely accepted if it's objected to initially. And literally is probably on the, in that 50 years now. Maybe in 50 years' time, nobody will think of it as at all odd. Some people don't think of it odd these days. It's often a generational thing. And other people object to it severely. So there are various words, and begging the question is another, that are in this period of experimentation, if you like, which might last quite a long time, before we finally decide or forget we are ever objected to it or discard the new use.
Of the words you choose to provide some source material and definition on, serendipity is one that certainly stands out, and that's got a fast. I mean, they all have fascinating etymologies, but where did serendipity come from?
Yeah, that was a word that was invented in the middle of the 18th century by Hugh Walpole, the writer, Cast of Otranto and things like that. And before he wrote that, he was reading some book called The Three Princes of Serendip, and Serendip was an old name for Ceylon, Sri Lanka. And these three princes kept on making coincidental discoveries that by happy accident. And so having said that they were princes from Serendip or Sri Lanka, he developed serendipity from that as meaning the lucky chance of discovering something.
Well, it really is a fun book to go through, and we're glad you've spent time with us today. The book is called The Word Detective, Searching for the Meaning of It All at the Oxford English Dictionary. John Simpson, its author, our guest. John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, take care.